Welcome to Hungry Authors, the show for aspiring authors who will stop at nothing to accomplish their writing and publishing dreams.
We're your hosts, Liz and Ariel, and we're honored that you're here. Let's dive in.
Hey friends, it's Ariel. Today we have a very special guest, and we're talking about something very near to my heart. As many of you know, my husband and I started fostering in the fall last year, and we have had the honor of parenting two incredible sweet girls. And like many people, many readers anyway, I went looking for books by other foster parents to help me navigate what is often an emotional roller coaster, as you'll hear. And I found the book Safe, a memoir of fatherhood, foster care, and the risks we take for family, which was written by today's guest, Mark Daly. Mark has over two decades of experience in message development, communication strategy, and public policy, including as a communications director for spokesperson and then Senator Hillary Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign. He's worked with more than 30 members of Congress, numerous governors, and other elected officials. He's the founder of One Iowa, the state's largest LGBTQ plus equality organization, and thefosterparent.com, a national platform to connect interested families with foster organizations. Mark has had lots of media surrounding his book. He's been on NPR and some really big podcasts, and we're so, so grateful that he said yes to chatting with us about the writing process behind this incredible book. Hey, Mark, welcome to the Hungry Authors podcast.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. So will you kind of start us off and just share a little bit about your book and kind of what you do now?
Absolutely. So my book is called Safe, a memoir of fatherhood, foster care, and the risks we take for family. I, by trade, sort of was a, I worked in politics for 12 years. I was, my last campaign was one of Senator Clinton, well, then Senator Clinton's press secretaries on her presidential back in 2008. And then I started a digital marketing agency, which I sold a few years later, and then another marketing agency. And then I got married, and my husband and I decided to start our family. We were looked into surrogacy, private adoption, foster care. And ultimately, we went back and forth between surrogacy and foster care, decided to foster, and thinking that we would do surrogacy later, but then realized that they gave us siblings, and that sort of changed everything for us. You know, you only wanted so many kids, you know. And so what the book really is it's the story of my husband and I and our foster care journey. You know, and how we go from two guys meeting and falling in love to deciding to grow our family, and really sort of our experience with the foster care system, Ariel. And I know you have your own personal journey with it as well, but it chronicles that experience that we went through and sort of the ups and downs, and giving a lot of information into the foster care system overall nationally, but of course in going a little more in detail in Los Angeles County where I live as well.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we're excited to talk about that. So one thing that I've been thinking about a lot lately, what makes a good memoir is the author's journey of transformation. And in order for an author to transform, you have to take action. Like there has to be a sense of agency. You have to, you know, take steps and kind of own your destiny in some way. But in foster care, I don't know if you felt that way, but I feel so often that like I have no control. I have no agency. I'm literally just at the mercy of the caseworkers and, you know, people who are outside of my scope, and no one asks my opinion, that's for sure. And and so how did you think about writing a story about, and you did it beautifully, about, you know, your journey and how you and your husband have changed and grown? Obviously you've become parents. That's a big factor to this. But how did you think about your journey through this experience?
Thank you. Yeah. You know, it's, and I'm going to spoil the book here for people, but you know, the story is we get two little boys who are 3 months and 13 months old. We have them for a little over a year or around a year and a half. And they reunify. And really what happened was they reunify, and I'm with a friend of mine who works in media, and she says to me, why don't you write like an op-ed or something, like, you know, about your journey? Like, what if you did like a 4-part series for the LA Times or something? And it's like, that's a really good idea. And so I started to like map out what it would look like. And I realized I couldn't do it in 4 op-eds. It needed to be a book. And that's really what what sort of led me to the journey of doing this, you know, and that feeling of having no control, that's exactly how I felt, you know. And the more I thought about that, it was like, as much as I had no control, think about those children who really have no control. You know, they don't even get their voices heard. Some of them can't even speak, you know. So yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is such a good point. I think I'm curious too how you did so much research for the book, because something I was continually delighted by, and by the way, I listened to the audiobook, which you narrated and was fantastic. But I felt
Thanks.
like in every single chapter, there were just these super interesting nuggets, statistics about fostering. And even as someone who is a foster parent, a lot of it was completely new to me that I had no idea. So how did you do some of the research for this as well?
You know, well, I am a big nerd at heart. You know, when I, before my first job out of college was working on the Hill before I got into the press side, I was doing more of the legislative side, and I loved policy. And ultimately, the initial idea for this book was, I'm going to write a policy book on how to fix foster care. And I started to do some homework, and then I met with my agents, or my now agents, and they said to me, "Well, no, you're not, because no one's going to be interested in that book." And then I also learned quickly that I didn't know the answer. You know, I tell a story early on in the book about we were in foster care training, and we kept asking the questions to our trainer about, you know, well, what happens in this situation? What happens in this situation? And she answered by saying, you know, if someone wrote a book on foster care, it would be called It Depends, because every situation is different. Every judge is different. Every kid is different. Every caseworker is different. Every parent is different. I'm like, oh, you're absolutely right. Like, it just, you really don't know until you get into it. So it's not something that a cookie cutter approach can solve for anybody or for everybody, you know? But so I did a ton of research. And then one of the things I did too was I actually, I have some friends who are some of the leading professors in this space around the country. And so I went to them, and I ended up hiring one of their TAs to go through and fact check me, just to make sure, you know, am I using the right information? And, you know, there's so many data sets out there, and am I looking at a study that's outdated? Is there a better one? Or, you know, and so I felt really confident in what we were putting out because of that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. One thing that we get asked a lot by aspiring memoirists is, how do you decide what to include? And I know for your story, this was like, had an extra layer to it, because you're also trying to protect the identity of these boys and not just like remove their names, but remove details about, you know, identifying
locations.
Details about who they are. Right. Like, exactly. And so, yeah, I mean, I know this isn't like, there's no perfect process, but describe for us a little bit about how you made those decisions, what stories to tell, what not to tell, what to include, what not to include. You know, it's especially hard for memoirists, because a lot of times people sit down and they're like, you know, well, they want to say everything, but how do you decide what's interesting for the narrative and for the reader? And like, you know, to Ariel's point about that ultimate transformation, your transformation, how did you make those editorial decisions?
Well, I will say, you know, there was a lot of stuff that got cut. So I didn't always do the best job of that, but it might be cut by, you know, my editors at Simon Schuster and Adria, or, you know, my lit agent, who is also a writer. So she was able to weigh in and say, you know, I don't think you need that. But I think in some ways I kind of just wrote a lot of stuff. And then I was like, you know, you got to go back to the question, does this move the story forward? And if it's something that's, you know, it might be a great story. You know, I remember there was this one scene in there that I initially had in the first draft that was a scene between me and my dad. And it was a powerful story about us and our relationship, but that really didn't advance the story. It didn't come back to like anything else in the end that said, this is why I am who I am, or whatever it is. So ultimately it got cut. You know, I mean, so I think there's a lot of that stuff where it really comes down to, does it move the story forward or not? You know.
How did you think about, you know, protecting like the boys themselves? Cause that's something I have a Substack newsletter I write often. I always feel like I'm kind of towing this line of like, how much do I say about, you know, my girls? How much do I not say? I want, you know, obviously I want it to feel very personal, and you did a great job in your book. It felt I mean, I feel like I know Amber, I know Logan, I know Ethan. You know, I feel like I could just envision them in my mind. But how did you think about, you know, how to treat their story with obvious, you know, sensitivity?
Well, I think at the end of the day, too, it comes down to, I care very deeply for all of them, Amber and Zach as well. I mean, I think these are people that have just, they've been through stuff in their life that I can't even imagine, and there's this scene towards the end where, we have this social worker, and we had some great social workers, but we had one who was a nightmare. And every time we would try to schedule something with her, it was just, she would schedule two things at the same time in different parts of the city, and LA traffic, there's no way you could possibly be there. It's just, and it was so frustrating and all these things. And we're going to see the boys, and we're at their house, and Amber makes this comment about, being frustrated with Nadia, the social worker. And she says, the other day I had to go get drug tested, and when I got to the address she sent me, it was a 7-Eleven. And it was like this moment of realization for me where I was like, as hard as this is for us, and as frustrating as that is for us, and we are two professional, successful men with cars and disposable income and things that, stress that, I mean, different kinds of stress than this woman, like how challenging it must be for her. And I think that, like, at the end of the day, it was like coming back to, I really do care about them, and I wanted to protect them. And then, so we changed their identities, we changed locations, we did a whole bunch of things to make sure that, that was there. And then, of course, we have the legal team that reviews everything too, to make sure that we're covered too.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's always good to have kind of that, you know, that's one of the benefits of a traditional publisher for sure. But I know that's something that a lot of memoirists really worry about is like, what are people going to think when this book comes out? They know I wrote it. They know I'm talking about them, even if I've changed their, you know, their identity and stuff, and no one else knows, but they know. So yeah, has that come up?
I think down the road, I'm like, my hope is that, should the boys read it someday, I just want them to know how worthy of love they are and how loved they are, and I think that was really what my hope for them was. But my bigger hope is, Ariel, this, like, not everyone can nor should foster. It's not for everyone. There's a crisis level need in every part of the country, and I want people to do this, but my goal wasn't to talk people into doing this. The people who are going to do it know they're going to do it. I want us all to think about this on our radar screen. So when we get these calls from people asking for our vote, or they knock on our doors, or they ask us for money, we say to them, "Hey, what are you doing about foster care?" And just the nature of hearing that from people who vote, from people who care, people who give a voice to these children who don't have one, that changes the way they legislate. And we need that so desperately in this country.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, that's really interesting. I'd never considered that, like that aspect of it or that outcome that, you know, that yeah, to like politicize it, I guess, in a positive way. I mean that in a positive, you know, like there are things that can be done. So let's talk about that. I have a question about, I know, and this is much more pertinent to Ariel's life than mine. I don't have personal experience with the foster care system. Honestly, outside of being good friends and business partners with Ariel, and reading books like yours. But you know, you had the boys for like 18 months or so, right? So how did you, you know, you could talk about this editorially if you want to, but I mostly mean personally, how did you deal with this, the uncertainty of how long they would be there and their fate and your fate, and on a daily basis loving them and advocating for them and caring for them, but really not knowing how long they would even be in your life?
Not well. That was. Yeah, no, I mean,
Honesty, yes.
it's funny, and I talk about this a lot in the book. It's like, that was the biggest, that was the 800-pound gorilla that weighed on me every night. I started having panic attacks, right? I mean, there were things like, and it was the simplest things of like, should I be saving for their college, right? Or not? Or, you know, what about Little League? Like, will we ever play that? Will they ever be in that? Well, what do we do? How do I plan for tomorrow or plan for 5 years from now when I don't know what tomorrow looks like? You know, I had a big help in that my husband is, he teaches meditation. He's an actor by trade, but he teaches meditation and he's a very, wellness coach. And so very much lives in that mindset of like, where are your feet now? How are you, what can you do about that situation? Be present, and that was really helpful. But also there were times where, he's living in the now and I'm freaking out and we're not in the same sort of phase of where acceptance, like we're both not there. And so I don't want to talk to him, I want to talk to somebody who's where I am, and has that going on. So it's just a different, that's the hardest part is the uncertainty and the unknown and what that is. The layer on that, why that is the hardest part, honestly, is it's not because it's about me and planning, future vacations or whatever it might be, or saving for college. It's about if they leave my care, are they going to be safe? And that is the hardest thing to deal with. It's not about can these parents give them opportunities we could give them or material things. None of that matters. What matters is when they go back to this house, are they going to be neglected? Are they going to be beaten? Are they going to, are their parents going to use drugs? What are these what opportunities for their safety, for them to be harmed exist? And that's the fear,
Yeah, I do know that.
We just... I'm going to make Ariel cry. I'm sorry.
I know. I was like, I promised myself I'm not going to cry during this interview.
I might.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we can do it together. It's it's very just last week our 6-year-old had surgery and it was really scary for us. We knew that it was happening. My husband went and saw her beforehand, but we didn't know what happened afterwards. We never got an update on how the surgery went. It was just, we did the best we could and we, and it's hard too, even after, and you shared a little bit, of this after Ethan and Logan did reunite with Amber and Zach, you got to see them sometimes, but you saw things that concerned you. And I now know from personal experience how hard that is to have no power to be able to say, I see something that concerns me because I love this kid so much. I love them like my own.
Yeah.
And I see that they are not happy and I see that they're not loved and not cared for in the way that, I would do it or whatever. It's just, it is heartbreaking.
Yeah. It's devastating on that end, and the part of it is accepting that other folks can't, there's different parenting styles, of course. And there's different, I grew up in a very working class family with two parents who, were married. And I was very, I've had so many privileges in my life and I fully understand that, and recognize that. And their parents didn't have any of that. And so, their mother had never had someone modeling parenting in a right way for her. It was really a challenge, to see that stuff.
Yeah.
You're right.
How has it been kind of on the other side now? The book is out. Talk to us about, what were some of the fears that you had with it kind of being out in the world? How have any of those come to fruition? Or what has been, what has been the reception of the book? I feel like, I heard you on NPR. I heard you on the Rachel Hollis podcast. So I know that, you've gotten a lot of really positive reviews, but talk to us a little bit more about what's happened now that the book is out.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I thought writing it would be the hard part, and that is actually the easy part, it turns out. It's selling it and marketing that's really the hard part. When you think about media, it's like media is not what it used to be. There isn't a book editor at every, newspaper in the country. I mean, most towns don't even have a newspaper anymore. Like it's really hard to get people to know about your book. And I think for me, what I was very lucky to do is that obviously I had a wonderful team between, Simon Schuster, Atria, that have been really helpful in promoting it. I did hire an outside publicist as well. And, you know, I kind of used a lot of my background in campaigns on like just grassroots marketing, you know, and how do I get people to know about the book and buy the book? And it's a lot of work. It's a lot of bootstrapping. You know, I think of the story of Brene Brown with her car, selling them out of the trunk, you know, I mean, that she talks about in one of her early books, but it's far more familiar than now than it was when she was talking about it, you know. It's just hard to break through.
Yeah.
So Oprah, if you're listening, call me.
Yeah. Oh, that's the key. Oprah. Okay. I laughed right when you said I was on mute, but when you're like, oh, marketing is so much harder than writing it, because Ariel and I have a book coming out in August, and I was like, oh, good. That's what welcome is.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, we are in publishing, so we kind of already knew that from the beginning. But I was, to your point, I was like at Bunko the other night, which is a thing I do as a 30-something-year-old. I told that to a client today. I was like, something, something at Bunko. And she's like, oh, my mom plays Bunko. And I was like, yes, your mom plays Bunko.
Usually right after pickleball.
Yeah, right. But anyway, there's like 12 of my buds, and we were playing Bunko. And I said something about my book. And I was like, oh, it's on Amazon. And she was like, oh, wow. And she like pulled it up. And she's like, guys, look, like, did you know Liz's book, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, no, seriously, guys, like, can you just buy it like right now? Like,
please.
I'm not joking. Like, please buy it. Like,
please
stop Bunko. Yeah. I was like, this is what my life has come to. Anyway. Yeah. Cool. Well, has anything surprised you about them? I mean, obviously you're trying to get people to like buy books.
Yeah, of course.
How much, you know, as you kind of have done your publicity tour of, you know, trying to get your story out in the world, have you enjoyed talking about this subject? I mean, obviously you wrote a book on it, but I know I've heard from other authors sometimes they're like, oh, well, I had to write it, and, you know, now I have to talk about it every day, all day, you know what I mean? I was like, but, you know, like, just tell us a little bit about what, you know, the talking about it, sharing it, reliving parts of it, you know, like, has that been rewarding? Has it been tiring? Has anything surprised you? You know, what's that sort of been like?
I will say, I think it's funny. And I think that's a really great question, because what that feeds into is like, there's a couple things. Like, first of all, writing it to me, because it was a memoir and because it was a very hard thing that I've lived through, it was very therapeutic. And so I felt like it really helped me to heal in the process, right? Like writing it did. Putting it out into the world got a little nerve-wracking, you know, because you're like, this is, it's so deeply into my vulnerability and being raw. And, you know, my agent had said to me early on, if you're not going to get raw, then we don't, you know, then it's not going to be a good book. And so I like really took that to heart and got extremely raw, which I think was helpful and made the book better. That being said, now that I'm out like talking about it, it's one of those things where, you know, it's like, I try to tell people, I'm like, yeah, it's a story about like how we got these two boys and then we lost them and we're really sad. And people are like, well, this doesn't sound like anything I want to read. And I'm like, no, but it's actually fun. Like, there's, you know, like, parenting is hysterical. Like, we're two guys who've never had kids before. I mean, he was like a baby whisperer, thank God, because I was a hot mess. Like, it was just, the whole thing was hysterical. I mean, and there's a lot of moments in there of like, you know, where people are laughing at, you know, I mean, the readers have said to me, like, I laugh so hard at this part or this, you know, but there's also, you know, there's obviously a serious side to it as well. And it's like, I try to tell people, I'm like, no, it's fun. You'll like it. I swear, you know, but it's hard to like, how do you tell people, hey, it's a book about foster care, but it's really funny. You know, it's doesn't really work that way.
Well, and it is definitely very funny. There was a lot that I could, you know, obviously I feel like I've just was a very similar situation. My husband and I do not have our, you know, biological kids of our own. And so when we were handed an 8-month-old baby, I mean, the caseworker left and we were like, oh my gosh, what do we
what
do
now?
Now? I guess we feed it a bottle. Like, what do we do? How do you make a bottle? There were so many things.
Like, yeah. And like when you're having a baby, you know, biologically, you have this like, you know, 40 week window of preparation, and you generally know the size, it's going to be. You might even know the gender. And so you know what are like these, this is my checklist of things, or you can Google it, or a friend or someone's going to tell you these are the things you need at your house. But when you're saying, okay, I'll accept a baby 0 to 3, all right, what size? Is that bottles, or is that sippy cups? Is, you know, do I need bibs, or like, how does this work? You know, it's hysterical. And so like the day the boys arrived, you know, it was like the one day of the month that I was traveling, and I got home, you know, we got a call at 1, they were there at 5. I didn't get home till like 10 o'clock at night. One of them's upstairs in a crib. The other one is like in my husband's arms, and my kitchen looked like Babies R Us had just vomited in it. I mean, there was a crib in the corner that was filthy. I mean, not a crib, I'm sorry, a high chair that was filthy. And I was like, that wasn't there in the morning, you know, but a friend had brought hers over. It was just hysterical, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know one of the things that I loved reading, you know, and hearing in your book was just the way that your community really came around you and supported you. You have so many, you know, friends, and your family was so supportive.
Yeah.
And we have felt very much the same thing. And we're, you know, so incredibly grateful. But it constantly makes me think, you know, there is so much that people can do to contribute to foster care, even if they are not foster parents. If being a foster parent is not the right fit for you, there is so many things that you can do to support foster parents, to support the kids. I mean, we had a birthday party for our 6-year-old just a couple weeks after she came to stay with us. And we were like, you know, we don't know anyone with a 6-year, you know, with 6-year-olds, but our community showed up to celebrate the 6-year-old. Literally none of them knew her. Not a single person there had met her before. Everyone came to throw her an incredible birthday party. And it just, I mean, things
a
like
core
that.
Memory for her.
Yeah. And how do you beat that? Like, and that kind of an experience would not be possible outside of this. I mean, it's really beautiful.
Yeah, we actually have the exact same experience. I mean, our kids have been with us a little bit longer before their birthdays, but it was, you know, all of our friends showed up, and it was just, you know, I remember like one of them, my friends walking by with, you know, the older of the two on his shoulders, just like belly laughing, you know, as they're running around the backyard, and I'm, you know, filling up a pretzel bowl or something. And it was just this, like, you know, this community that just dove in to support, you know. And I think honestly, on the flip side, when you have these families that are losing children to the system, so much of it is because they don't have a foundation of support. You know, they don't have the aunt stepping in, or the grandmother, or the friend, or, you know, I think about if something were going on with one of my siblings and their children, how quickly I would intervene, and or my parents would, or, you know, because we have one another. And in so many of these cases, that's part of the reason these kids end up in care in the first place. You know?
Yeah. I have often just kind of wondered about how, you know, as foster parents, we do receive so much support. I mean, support in a lot of different ways. And I'm often like, if, you know, if our girls' parents had received that support instead of us receiving it, maybe they wouldn't even be in care. And that is a very sobering thing to think about. I don't know what the answer is, but it's
Oh, well, I think it's, yeah, I think you're spot on. I think it's the solve for this is more upstream interventions, right? It's how do we get, you know, things from childcare for overworked and exhausted parents? How do we get, you know, drug rehabilitation? I mean, if you think about just the number of children that are entering foster care because of overdoses. Last year was a record number of overdose deaths in the country. I mean, and it's, and we now have an increasing number of women going in, that are incarcerated, and 80% of the women in jail in America have children who are minors. Where are those kids? Foster care. Like, of course, you know, it's really sad. It's the backstop of all of our challenges. If we had other solutions on the front end, these kids could be prevented from going in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, this certainly could be a failing on my part, but as a casual politics observer, I don't ever hear about that in the way that I hear about like abortion, which you know, is a really hot button issue. And people have lots of thoughts and opinions and on it, but there are lots of kids that are already born and need help, you know,
well,
like
and
why
how
isn't
many...
it? Yeah.
Well, and the number of and the children that in these that are going to be born as a result of not having access to reproductive freedom by lower income women who cannot travel to another state to have an abortion, those are the kids that are going to be most likely to enter the system. And so while the data is not out yet, we can expect to see an uptick in the numbers as a result of that. You know, it's just it's really it's disheartening. It's sad, you
Yeah, definitely.
know. On a lighter note, the book is funny, I swear.
Yeah, I was gonna say, anyone want to make a joke? Actually, I
Lots
did
of
have a thought.
Beyonce, Taylor Swift references, you
I did have a thought though earlier in the conversation when you're talking about it being funny, and that, I certainly wouldn't advocate for anyone. Like, if you don't want your memoir to be funny, you don't have to make it funny. Don't force humor, especially if you
Right.
aren't that funny. But I have found like a lot of the best memoirs that tackle a really hard subject, are funny. Like
Yeah.
I one we reference a lot is Jeanette McCurdy's memoir that's,
Yeah.
been a mega bestseller. I'm glad my mom died. And I feel like humor can be this, like I always I oh, well, occasionally we'll use the analogy of like it's like a shot chaser, like especially if
Yeah.
you're tackling something difficult like grief or foster care and loss, that like these hard topics actually not only is it the truth of life that they are sometimes funny and they have really funny elements, it helps people digest them, understand them, care about
Absolutely.
them, absorb them. If you take the edge off a little bit with the joke, you know what I mean? Like, I
Yeah.
found that a lot, especially in grief writing, where it's like, yeah, it's really hard to talk about hard things. So make a joke, lighten it up. It's like,
Right.
it's like taking the tension out of the writing a little bit, kind of. You know what I mean?
I think you have to at times. You know, it's funny. It's my agent is a I think is 6 or 7 time now New York Times bestselling author, a ghostwriter, and it's Laura Love Hardin who wrote The Many Lives of Mama Love. I don't know if you've read that yet, but it was one of Jeanette's
Obsessed.
books.
I just
Okay.
bought it based on Liz's recommendation and one of
Yeah.
our other guests' recommendations. So I haven't started it yet, but good to know.
Okay, well, we're
She's
gonna talk about that later. Yeah, okay, go ahead.
so without ruining, I mean, well, I guess you already know her story, but I will. I mean, so how I signed with her was her then business partner was a friend of mine, and I after the boys had reunified and I decided I was going to write this book, I had said I had called him up and said, all right, I didn't know her. I called him and said, hey, can I come in and meet with you? I want to have this idea for a book. And he's like, absolutely, come in. So I went in and we sat down and he said, this is Laura. She runs the memoir division. And I said, great. And so I sat down and talked to her and I shared our whole story. And they said to me, you have a great book, but you don't have an ending. You know, you have act one and you have act two, but you don't have act three. And of course, in my head, I was like, yeah, you're wrong. And then I went back and I like mapped out all the scenes and I was like, no, they're absolutely right. And that's what they do. And that's why they're really good at it because they're right. And so fast forward a couple of years, at this point, Laura and I got to know each other and we became friends, you know, and I learned her story, which, as you know, she soccer mom who with an MFA who develops an addiction issue with pain meds, which turns into heroin, which turns into her losing her kid to foster care, going to prison for a year. Coming out of jail, getting her kids back, and going on to become this ghostwriter, and then now, you know, self writing her own memoir, which is now Oprah's current book club, and it's amazing. And she said to me, "What I
What's
loved
your
about yours,
strategy? Your publicity strategy, Oprah.
yeah, right, exactly, exactly." So they, you know, but I said to her, "I was like, hey," or she said to me, "She's like, you know, part of what I liked about you was that you didn't." You know, you recognize the challenges that the families faced and you were empathetic to them. It wasn't just like these are bad people, and they're not bad people. They're people who've been through a hell, right? And it was sort of we came at this from two different sides. She was the parent who had to fight to get her kids back and faced a grueling system. And I was the person who was living at the mercy of the grueling system, trying to see, figure out what was going to happen and worrying whether or not the kids go home if they're going to be safe. And in Laura's writing, you know, she uses comedy. I mean, she's hysterical. She does improv and, you know, everything else. So she's hysterical to begin with. And I think we're just similar people in that. And I think so when it came to the voice, initially I was going to use a ghostwriter for my book. And then as soon as I started to write, she was like, oh no, you're going to do this. Like that was, you know, and so it ended up being that, you know, that I would write it and, you know, obviously I think she really appreciated the humor because for the same thing, it's heavy. You know, and she, you know, she's got some, you know, side-splitting lines in her book, you know.
How validating, to have her say,
Seriously, you're right.
I mean, seriously, kudos to you, and it's beautiful.
Well, that's actually so what happened to me was when we started to, I wrote out all these scenes after we'd met and realized we didn't have, this was the end of Act Two. We got to the end of Act Two was where the kids reunify and we're like, what happens now, right? And then, and as my story plays out, as you all know, a little over a year later, we get a text from a girlfriend of ours that there are three kids who are in the system who are not going to be reunified. And if we're interested, we'd probably be able to adopt them. And we were just about to start a surrogacy process. And we ended up hitting pause on that and seeing finding out the story. And of course, we found the story. We fell in love with kids. So they moved into our house and we were on our way to adoption. 10 months later, we got a call saying the boys were back in care. Would we take them in? And ultimately, we made the really difficult decision to say no. They had another sister, which would they had a younger sister, which would have given us six children. And we just felt that it was really hard decision, but we ultimately thought we needed to be the best thing we could do for them was to hope that they ended up with another loving family that could care for them because we wouldn't be able to care for all six kids the way that they needed. And so, but it, all of a sudden it was like, I have Act Three, and then a global pandemic broke out and I was, sitting at my house thinking, what am I going to do with this time? And I really didn't want to make sourdough bread. And so I just pulled up on my list of all my scenes and started mapping them out. And I emailed Lara and said, hey, I've been spending a lot of time on this. I know you do this for a living. I don't want to impose on our friendship, but if you would spend 10 minutes looking at this and tell me if I have something there or not. And she said, absolutely, but I'm on a deadline. Give me 2 weeks. And I was like, yeah, of course, whenever, no big deal. And she emailed me back 2 weeks later and I got the email. I opened it up. I started to look through her notes. And as I was looking through, I got a text from her and then the phone just rang and it was her. And I was like, what do you think? Am I wasting my time? And she's like, no, I want to sign you. And that was how it happened.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well,
I
what
had
I
such a
love.
dream. I mean, I hate telling
Yeah.
people that are aspiring writers that like, oh, I happen to be friends with, these people, but it was a dream. Sorry.
Okay, but really, I mean, that is a big part of succeeding in this industry and getting a traditional book deal. I mean, it's we do say it, and we have former or prior episodes about the importance of networking. If you want to be traditionally published, because it really does make a difference. And you see that the writers who succeed, the authors who end up being in the places where a lot of our listeners want to go, they have friends, they make friends, they join writing groups, they make connections, and they don't just let those connections fade away. They call them up, they take action in some way, just like you did. So I think that's a perfect example.
I think also it's about like when you're in that situation, it's about paying it forward. Like there's plenty of room for us all to succeed, and everyone has stories they want to tell and they should be telling. It's like, open your Rolodex to everybody if they're, if you believe in it.
I also want to point out a writerly thing that you said that we talk about a decent amount in Map Your Book, which is our little cohort program that we run. It's not little, it's fantastic, and you should all join it. Take that back. Cut that out.
Absolutely.
But what you said was you mapped out scenes, which is something that we talk to memoirists about a lot, because sometimes when I meet with an aspiring memoirist, they'll go, well, I grew up here, and then I had this hard thing, and then this thing happened, and I learned this, and that's fine. Like having a kind of overview biography is helpful and good context. But what I really want them to do is tell me the scenes, the granular, the moments. I want you to really zoom in, because that's actually what anchors the story. Sure, there's connective tissue and exposition and some background and all that kind of stuff that happens in the actual wholeness of the book, but where it starts and where you know what it's really about and if you really have something or what you're actually trying to say is often there. Like I will sometimes tell people, like, think it, this is a movie. It's a movie. So like, what are the actual scenes? I want the moments. I want you in the room talking to this person. Like, tell me those things. And those are often what anchor it. So I don't know. I love that I don't know if that was just your instinct from the beginning or, you know, how did you do that?
Well, I will say, I think a couple things. One is, when I met with Laura and Doug, her then business partner, they gave me some of the ideas, and I saw how they map out some of their other books. I think at the time it might have been like Just Mercy or one of them that was like up on the wall in their, the whiteboard. So it was like, I'm up looking at like, this is my like, wow, this is how you do this. So I had a leg up, let's just say that, right? But I think, but you're absolutely right. It's mapping these scenes out in this way of like, a scene has to have like a positive or a negative charge that like flips, right? Like, so it's like, what
Yes.
happens? What's the reveal in each scene? If there's no reveal, then it's just filler, right? And so if it starts here, it has to end here, or vice versa. Like, what is the purpose of this scene? And I think that's what made it easy for me to say, like, all right, what makes the most sense? The other thing that I had, which was a big leg up, is like I was looking at a time frame of like, we decide to foster and then the kids reunify and we adopt our kids. Like that's the timeline of the book. That being said, we also have, I mean, I can go back and do flashbacks to my childhood and I can do all of these other things, but I have that's the timeline. And during that time, Ariel, you'll be able to relate to this, is like you have to keep a visitation and communication log. So anytime you hear from the birth parents or you have a visit scheduled, you keep this like spreadsheet. Well, my husband built one that would have been like the envy of CPAs anywhere. And so I had this like incredible chronological record of what had happened during that time, which most people don't have. So I knew exact, because in your memory, you're like, oh, wait, we're in court, but was that the first hearing or the second hearing? Or, and then obviously I have this record from him that was like, oh, okay, well, that was then, this was then. So I knew all the scenes. And so I could pick out like this makes the most sense, but now I need to introduce us and who we are, and like so I can throw in some backstory here. I can talk about coming out. I can talk about these other challenges that I've had and how that leads me to where I am at this point in time. But I mean, it is it's just a collection of scenes, right? I mean, and looking at in as sort of the three acts, like think about it as how does this get put up onto a show? The first thing when I did the Fresh Air interview with Terry Gross. Before we went live on the air, we were just chatting, and she said to me, "Oh," she said, "Mark, I loved your book, and I have to tell you, it read so fast." She said, "I have to ask you who's optioned it," and I was like, "Terry, I can't tell you that yet." But I was like, "But she was like, it just read like a movie. It read like this is a series or something like that, And that's what's so exciting about it is that I mean, I think that's what people have to think about is like, how does this come to life on screen, The other really great piece of advice they gave me is like if you think about from a memoir standpoint, it's sort of like the alphabet where the alphabet runs A to Z. A memoir does too, but it usually starts somewhere around H, goes back to A, and then follows all the way through Z. So if you have that chronological thing, for me, initially my first draft, I started it with like our wedding day and then moved forward. And my editor at HR said to me, I think you shouldn't start it there. I think you should start it later. And the reason is because it sets this tone that this is this gay love story, and that's not the book. The book is the parenting journey. And I was like, okay, well, first, of course, I was like, well, I got to figure out how to wrap my head around that because I really like the way it is. But basically, what is chapter two became or was chapter one. And I created a new chapter now that is, I started with our foster care training and then went back into, well, how did we get here? And then moved it forward so the people knew or the reader knew this was a story about parenthood, not a story about our love story.
Yeah, that's one of our favorite structures to teach in our Map Your Book cohort, and we've called it the and we've heard other memoirs called the letter E format. So you start at a place, you kind of loop back around, and then keep going with
Yeah.
it. So, but yeah,
Oh, I like
same.
that.
Yeah, I mean it's the same idea. I like the use of the letters too. That makes it really clear. Hey friends, it's that time again. If you've been wanting to learn about our bespoke book mapping process that has helped hundreds of authors plan and write the book of their dreams, we have good news. Registration is now open for our next Map Your Book cohort, which runs May 7th through June 4th. In 5 90-minute sessions and weekly Q&A meetings, we'll help you figure out your book's transformation and teach you how to map out your entire book, chapter by chapter. Book mapping is the invisible matrix that makes books work. We're going to teach you how to see it and how to do it for your own book. Head to mapyourbook.com to learn more and sign up for our May cohort.
That was it was such an amazing, I mean, just the journey of being able to do this. You know, I've always enjoyed writing, and writing has been like my favorite part of any job I've ever had. And I've always wanted to write a book at some point in time, but I never thought I had a story until, you know, this girlfriend of mine said, "Hey, you know, you should write the op-ed." And I was like, "You know what? This is the book. But it's, you know."
So do you think you'll write another one? I'm sure you've been asked that before.
I would love to. I don't
Yeah.
know, you know, I don't know what it would be yet. You know, I do have some writing projects in the work right now, but I'm not 100% sure what, you know, where, as far as like from a book standpoint, I don't know yet. You know, I do have
Yeah.
this weird fascination. I'd love to write like, you know, the Beyonce memoir or something like that. Could be a
Yeah.
ghostwriter for somebody amazing like
Get in line, buddy.
that. Okay, Liz, we can do it together.
There we go. You could. I mean, you absolutely could be a ghostwriter.
I'll take Taylor Swift. You can have Beyonce, I
Oh,
guess.
I know. I know. It'd be amazing.
Know,
So
right?
good.
Oh, that's so
Gosh.
fun. Oh my gosh. Any like final thoughts for aspiring authors who are listening, or people who are a bit potentially interested in being foster parents? I don't know that we've sold it in this episode, but
Well, I would say, you know, the foster parent thing is something to think long and hard about. I have a site called thefosterparent.com. If you are interested, wherever you live in the country, you can go on and get more information or be connected with a local agency. And then as far as writers, you know, I years ago I met with this amazing writer, Jim Ennis, who's got some TV shows, Dexter and other folks that he's created. And we were talking one day and he was telling me about some project that he was working on, and I was just like drooling on the other table with jealousy, on the other side of the table, just with, you know, jealous of everything he was saying. And I was like, you know, I was like, it'd be such a dream to write. And he's like, just write, just do it. And I think, you know, that's like the advice that I would give anybody is you just have to make the time. I mean, the majority of my book was written between the hours of 4:30 in the morning to 7 a.m. I would get up, I would write, there's no distraction. And then at 7 o'clock, I get the kids up and out the door for school. And then I go work my real job. Like, you just have to make time for it and do it, you know, because it's what you want to do.
It's so true. It's so true for all writers. All right. Well, thank you again,
Yeah.
Mark, for coming on today. We're just so thrilled, and everyone
Thank
should
you all
go.
so much for having me.
Yeah. We'll be sure to link to your book in the show notes as well.
I so appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you're a hungry author and you want to learn more about our community and courses, head over to hungryauthors.com. Remember, you have a story and a message worth sharing, and if you've got the hunger, you can make it happen.